Hey everybody, you are listening to The Poison Lab, a show about poisoning from people who manage poisoning. I'm your host, clinical toxicologist and emergency medicine pharmacist Ryan. Today is such an informative episode. If you are curious about the novel opioids, benzodiazepines, stimulants, hallucinogens, whatever drug you can imagine that's popping up in the nation's drug supply, or your patients showing up to the emergency departments, we are interviewing the guy who finds those drugs, Dr. Alex Kratulski of the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. Dr. Kratulski and the team at the CFSRE routinely screen seized drug product specimens, samples from patients presenting for overdose at emergency departments, and biologic specimens from fatal overdoses, using very sophisticated technology to look for every possible drug that can be there. They put out quarterly reports called the Novel Psychoactive Substances Quarterly Report, where they report the novel psychoactive substances that they're seeing. Now, novel psychoactive substances aren't our traditional drugs. So usually in an overdose, you're going to see things like fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, benzodiazepines. And those things do show up when the CSFRE are doing their testing, but that's not what's going into these reports. These reports focus on novel psychoactive substances, the weird things or analogs of our traditional drugs, furanyl fentanyls, bromazolam instead of alprazolam. And we're going to learn about all sorts of new ones that are beginning to emerge in the U.S. markets, as well as a detailed history of where they're coming from, what used to be there, and what's going to be there next. I'm going to warn you up front, this is a longer episode and it's dense. We cover a lot of topics. I almost split it into two episodes, but instead, I'll leave it all right here for you, and I am going to meticulously timestamp in the show notes where we talk about specific topics, benzos, what the novel opioids are, the difference between GCMS and QTOF, so that you can skip to a section that you're most interested in, or go back and re-reference that information later. There'll be something in this episode for everyone, those who have a mastery of NPS down to those who have never heard of a nitazine opioid. If you're like me, you've read many of these reports, but you might not know the ins and outs of how they're made, or even what the Center for Forensic Science and Research is. So we kick off the episode with the first 30 minutes learning more about Dr. Kratulski's background and the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. And then getting into the nitty-gritty of what kind of data goes into these reports and what kind of analytical equipment they use to find these drugs. We actually get a mini crash course in the difference between GCMS and QTOF, or time of flight type analysis. For the rest of you who are here just to learn about what these new drugs are, we're going to start really diving into the report around minute 32. We kick off diving into the novel benzodiazepines, learning about things like bromazolam and why etizolam has gone away. Then we go on an in-depth discussion into novel opioids, learning about where carfentanil is popping up in the nation, and new opioids like N-pyrrolidinoetanidazine, something that's potentially 40 times more potent than fentanyl, at least in a test tube. We learn about changes in the fentanyl analog trends, such as the wide prevalence of p-fluorofentanyl and the rising prevalence of orthomethylfentanyl. Then we'll take a jump into stimulants and hallucinogens, learning about novel ketamine derivatives, as well as the ever-prevalent bath salts. After that, we jump into one of Dr. Kratulski's favorite topics, synthetic cannabinoids. We get a very in-depth analysis of the SynCan market over the last 10 years or so, and learn about some new trends, while revisiting old ones, like the presence of bruticum and other superwarfarin rat poisons in the synthetic cannabinoid products. Lastly, we'll wrap it up with a discussion of the Wild West market of semi-synthetic cannabinoids like Delta 8, Delta 10, Delta 9 THC acid, and even these psilocybin mushroom chocolate bars that are being marketed on things like Facebook. You will gain some new and very insightful information from our guests. So tune in and take notes. Without further ado, let's dive in. Hey, everybody, you are listening to The Poison Lab, a show about poisoning for people who manage poisoning, and we have such an exciting expert guest on today. If you want to learn about what is in the drugs that your patients are taking. I mean, maybe you've heard of isotonidazine or methoxetamine or 5-HT-Fubinac. Well, we're talking to the person who actually finds those new novel psychoactive substances as part of his job. Dr. Alex Krotolsky is joining us today. So thank you so much for joining, Alex.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Yeah, I am really excited to meet you. I think we've never met, but I have definitely attended some of the Center for Forensic Science and Research's, which the listeners will learn more about, some of the webinars that you guys put on in your quarterly reports. And I do a fair amount of lectures kind of throughout the year on novel psychoactive substances for either internal physician groups or at conferences. And your group's data is some of the first stuff that I run to when I'm looking for what is out there. What are the new things that we're running into? So even though we've never met, I feel like I know you because I've seen you present. So
yeah, I feel the same way. I know we've emailed over the years and our paths have crossed electronically, but yeah, I don't think that I don't think we physically crossed. But I'm sure we will at some point.
At some point, yeah. So this virtual crossing we'll have to do for now. Yeah. Well, so for the listeners who may not be as familiar with you or your work, would you mind giving an introduction, who you are, where you're working right now, kind of how you got there, if you don't mind?
So my name is Alex Krotolsky. I am, by practice, a forensic toxicologist, but to get here was certainly a sort of different type of journey. So I have a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and my interest really from the start of my educational career was always in chemistry, and that's what you'll mostly find with many forensic toxicologists, is that our backgrounds are mostly in sort of the chemistry, analytical chemistry realm. I have a master's degree in forensic science, and that's where I got to learn about what forensic toxicology was. I'll say when I was in high school, I had no idea what forensic toxicology was, but once I started learning more about forensic science and kind of all the sub-disciplines that go under forensic science and learning more about drugs and their effects on humans and kind of what happens in that medical legal setting, forensic toxicology became extremely interesting to me. And I kind of latched onto that and found really a home and what is really an amazing community of people in the forensic toxicology world. And after I got my master's degree in forensic science, ended up getting my PhD in chemistry. So that's kind of my educational background. Throughout all of that time, did a whole bunch of research in the forensic space, mostly in the forensic toxicology space. And that's what led up to me joining. So I've been working at the Center for Forensic Science Research Education now for, this will be my 10th year. So I've been here almost a decade.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been quite a journey. I've had certainly the what I've done in my career has changed over time. We've had a lot of interest more recently and the work we've done, obviously, with novel psychoactive substances. But a lot of additional training in the pharmacology space to keep up with. So the training on the chemistry side and understanding what drug molecules look like, how we detect the drugs, all of that is training that we've gotten and expertise that we've been able to foster on myself and been able to foster over time. And then just been able to learn a lot more about the pharmacology side and really the toxicology side. One thing that's always been really interesting to me, and I always tell people, is that toxicologists are not all created equal, but it's really awesome to meet other toxicologists and kind of see how we all come to be toxicologists, medical toxicologists and forensic toxicologists come at things that from very different perspectives.
Right, right.
But I think we have obviously a shared common goal in the end. So
yeah, toxicology is a very broad scope. We all have different backgrounds, but we're all examining sort of, you know, the effects of substances on a biologic system in one way or another. And I love the fact that we have such diverse backgrounds. One of my absolute favorite things to do is corner a PhD in chemistry. So I'm glad that I have incarcerated you right here on my podcast for the next at least hour so we can chat about things. Because every time I get to talk to someone who's got that mastery of the basic sciences, I learn something really cool. I am hoping today that you will be the first person who can explain to me what a toff is, because I've tried multiple times to understand all these time of flight things, and it's just a lot. But I really appreciate that. Yeah, and the forensic side is really interesting. I've done some expert witness work, and the amount of times where I've found your name on a paper that I end up needing to use is more than five, probably. So I appreciate the work you guys are putting out there, because it is helpful in the medical legal realm to help understand some of these things. Can I ask one clarifying question? When you do a PhD in chemistry, do you have to choose like a subspecialty, or can it just be kind of like chemistry?
Yeah. So the degree is generally in chemistry, but then, yeah, you do choose a subspecialty. So my degree is from Temple University, and they had several different tracks. So my track was the analytical chemistry track, but then they had an organic chemistry track, physical chemistry track, and yeah, every university is set up a little bit differently. So there are the different subspecialties, and then that usually... The way it boils down is that each of those different subspecialties has required courses and then different types of electives. There's a lot of classes that relate to calculus and differential equations and kinetics and a lot of those things that are more analytical. Yeah. Whereas the organic chemistry side of it is going to relate a lot more to the synthesis, piecing together molecules, those types of classes.
I miss organic chem. It was a lot of fun. But the analytical is, you know, the kinetics, that's fun too. Got to be tough to choose. All right. Well, we're going to jump in for the listeners here so we can actually talk about what kind of drugs we are seeing show up in the illicit drug supply. And I feel like I have a glancing understanding of what the Center for Forensic Science Research is. I definitely know of it, and I know the work that it does. But I don't know, really, what is it, a physical location? I feel like people always, they're like, oh, you work at a poison center. So do they like bring poisoned patients to you and all that? And it's kind of, I feel similar, where people know what something is, but we don't really know. So would you mind giving us some background on what the Center for Forensic Science Research is, potentially who works there, and what is the goal of the organization?
Sure. Yeah. And I think the reason it's a little bit mysterious is that we are very much kind of like a unicorn. So the CFSRE is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So that makes us very unique in that it is probably pretty impossible to think of another nonprofit forensic laboratory in the United States. So we feel, we sit in kind of a very unique role.
Would other forensic laboratories be places like NMS or AREP? Or those are private companies that are doing forensic testing for like medical legal purposes?
Yeah. So most forensic laboratories would be laboratories that are either publicly funded, meaning that they are state or local crime labs or toxicology labs. So most medical examiner's offices that are in major cities will have their own toxicology lab associated with it. Other side of that is the for-profit labs like NMS Labs, ARUP, Access Forensic Toxicology, those types of labs.
Perfect. Okay. Just to clarify the landscape here. So you guys are the only nonprofit one that's out there.
I wouldn't say we're the only nonprofit. There are probably some others, but we're definitely in a very unique space. There's definitely pros and cons to it. The con of working for a nonprofit is that we have to seek out our funding. We're not a budget item on a city's budget or on the federal government's budget. So we have to seek out our funding. But the pro to it is that we have a very unique mission. We get to do what I think is really exciting and cool work. We get to change people's lives. So at least that's how I view it.
And yeah,
I think that's really exciting. So. So we are a nonprofit forensic laboratory. We do have a strong relationship with NMS Labs. So we are actually, we moved in December. We are actually in the same building as NMS Labs, but we are two completely separate organizations.
Wow.
A gentleman named Frederick Readers founded NMS Labs as a for-profit forensic laboratory. When he retired, he founded what's called the Frederick Readers Family Foundation, and that is the sort of operating name of our foundation, but our sort of business name is the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. So NMS Labs has probably about 400, 500 employees. We have about 30 or 40, so we're quite small and being a nonprofit, but and then we have a very different mission. As our name suggests, our mission really is more research and education related. Our sort of subject matter expertise is in three different areas: forensic toxicology, forensic chemistry, and forensic biology. The forensic toxicology and forensic chemistry areas overlap very, very much in that they're drugs inside or outside the body. And our forensic chemistry division is dealing with DNA analysis and a lot of those sort of more novel techniques and research in those serological and DNA analysis realms. So yeah, so that's what we have a whole bunch of different grants and contract funding to do research work, which includes the work that we do to identify novel psychoactive substances and report out that data. And then we have a whole section of our organization that deals with education, whether it be through online symposiums and webinars, or through our graduate programs and training students through our collaborations with university partners.
Awesome. So the NPS Discovery Program, the Novel Psychoactive Substances Discovery Program, that is sort of an initiative of the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education,
CFSRE.
I was so close. All right. CFSRE. Is NPS Discovery a part of that?
Yeah, so NPS Discovery is a program that sits under the CFSRE.
Okay. And this is what we're largely going to be talking about today, the Novel Psychoactive Discovery Program. Do you have other programs that are going on in terms of the CFSRE, their kind of toxicology and chemistry blanket?
We do. We have other programs that are in the educational realm as well. We have different STEM programs. We have a high school science program and things. But we do have other sort of sub-discipline under the CFSRE in different areas. We have an initiative with the State Department. We have work that we've done looking at drug-impaired driving and different research in that area. But yeah, our NPS Discovery Program, so we launched our NPS Discovery Program in 2018, really as a response to the fact that information on NPS wasn't being shared very well. At that time, we had a collaboration with Customs and Border Protection, and we were getting samples from express mail facilities. So samples coming into the United States through express mail. Those samples were being sequestered, sent to us. We were identifying new drugs entering the United States. We were identifying them for the first time. We didn't really have a good way of telling people that those drugs, that we were identifying those drugs, and those drugs existed in the United States. So that's why we initially launched our NPS Discovery Program in 2018. And since then, things have just sort of expanded and exploded. Early on, we were excited about telling people that drugs existed, but we very quickly found out that that wasn't the end of the story. We needed to tell people, well, how often were we seeing them? Where were we seeing them? What were the impacts? And that's really how our program has grown. So it's grown from identifying drugs in powders on their first instance in the United States to looking at how they're trending, seeing how often we're identifying them in medical legal death investigations, to trying to get a better sense of what drug supplies look like. We have a number of collaborations now with public health departments and their drug checking programs in a number of cities across the country, looking at what drug supplies look like in various regions of the country. We have a number of collaborations with clinical partners, including the American College of Medical Toxicologists, looking at what drugs are in systems that they're presenting emergency departments.
That's the toxic fentalog investigators. I know, well, and I assume probably other programs too. A lot of people listening are probably familiar with toxic, which is a kind of database sub-registry of the American College of Medical Toxicology. And they run a fentalog program where basically they send discarded, well, plus some other things, but they send discarded biologic samples from patients presenting to emergency departments with suspected overdose. And, you know, they get treated. We almost never know what's in their system, but they actually send off the biologic samples to you guys, right? And you will do broad analysis to see what's actually in their system. So we can look back and say, oh, they were, that was actually p-fluorofentanyl or whatever, all those things. Yes. Is that part of it? Is the toxic fentanyl group part of the NPS discovery data? And we're going to talk here about what kind of samples are you actually using, but I'm always curious if those two overlap.
So toxic fentanyl project, and now the toxic DOTS project as well, the drug overdose toxico surveillance study, I think that's what DOT stands for. Both of those studies do fall under our NPS umbrella, NPS discovery umbrella. So the way that we kind of view our NPS discovery program is that it really is our umbrella that sits over top of the way that we are trying to identify drugs in the United States, and all of the different programs that we have sort of funnel up into that.
Okay.
So those two programs, or those two studies in our collaborations with ACMT, fall under our NPS discovery program. And for the first time in Q1, the NPS that we're identifying as part of those studies do now or are now included in our trend reports.
In the trend reports. Okay. So let's get into those right now. So one of the reasons I find this so valuable is you guys put out these quarterly and annual trend reports of the different types of substances that you're finding. So let's talk about what samples you're doing this testing on. So as you just told, as of now, at least, you're looking at, you know, patients presenting to emergency departments, and if urine or blood is left over,
yeah,
you guys are going to do some testing on that if they're part of the toxic registry. So either the DOTS program or the Fentalog program. That's accurate?
Yes. So there's three different sample populations that flow into our trend reports. The first is our drug materials, which come from our collaborations with crime labs and with public health departments. The second is our forensic toxicology populations, which are primarily medical legal death investigations. So toxicology samples in collaboration with medical examiners and coroners. And then the third is our clinical populations, which are these samples that you're mentioning that are samples that come from the ACMT projects, which are people who are presenting to emergency departments. Initially, it was really focused on opioid overdoses, but it now really has expanded to opioid and stimulant overdoses, but actually really includes kind of all almost indiscriminate overdoses at this point, because a lot of times especially with the way the drug environment is, you may have multiple drugs on board, you may have NPS, so we have no idea what their toxidromes are going to look like. So we get samples that aren't necessarily just sort of your typical opioid toxidrome.
Right. So you're looking, we have product, we have fatality kind of samples, and we have living patient samples. And you're kind of doing broad analysis. So when somebody doesn't know what they're dealing with, they're going to send it potentially to you for a broad analysis of what's going on. I guess to understand how the quarterly reports work. So when I looked at them, you know, I'm seeing all sorts of novel psychoactive substances. So for example, let's look at the opioid quarterly report. You know, we're reporting out on nitazenes. We're reporting out on carfentanil is on there. But by and large, when you look at, you know, fatalities, fentanyl is the most common thing seen. So your reports, I'm not seeing the standard players, fentanyl, methamphetamine, alprazolam. Those wouldn't be included. Is that correct?
Correct. So fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, and their metabolites are the primary drugs that we do detect. But those get left off of our NPS reports. We really focus on what we define as being NPS, and there's different definitions of what is an NPS and what's not an NPS. We generally define that as what are your sort of new and novel drugs, and the sort of opposite of what an NPS is what a traditional drug is. So right. Something like fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine, sort of the opposite of those are the things that we include in our NPS discovery trend reports.
Right. So this is not necessarily like you wouldn't go to these reports to be like, how often is fentanyl showing up in someone's blood? You're going to go to these reports to be like, how often is something other than fentanyl showing up? Because right now, yeah, just like you said, the ME data and all this stuff shows a lot of fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, benzos. This is the new stuff that's not in there. I think that's just kind of an important point for any listener who's going to be going to this data to check things out.
I will just mention that we do have other reports on our website that do characterize how much fentanyl we're seeing. So in our drug checking reports and in our actual clinical reports, so as part of the ACMT, Fentalog, and DOTS projects, we issue quarterly reports as part of those projects. And in those, we do mention how much fentanyl we're seeing, and we do quantify how much fentanyl we're seeing in drug products and in blood samples. So in those specific reports, if somebody is interested in seeing how much fentanyl we're seeing, that can be in there. But for our NPS reports, we specifically kind of filter all of those legacy drugs, those traditional drugs out, and do focus more on the new and novel drugs.
And yep. And I did not know that you had that. And that's awesome. And I just went to the website, cfsre.org, under NPS discovery, the panel right at the top, you just click on drug checking. And there it is. So that's awesome. Here's the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania drug checking quarterly report. It looks like you have xylazine information in a lot of these things too. That's I'm going to spend a little bit more time reading those later. And in terms of the NPS reports that we're talking about, you tend to classify things into four categories. So we have stimulant and hallucinogens, opioids, benzos, and synthetic cannabinoids. Is there anything that we might be missing in terms of you're reporting out everything you find in those categories? What do we not see in these?
Yes, we do have a miscellaneous category. And I can give some examples of what falls into that miscellaneous category. And essentially, we made that category as a catch-all for things that don't fall into those other four categories. And things that are in the miscellaneous category are things that we don't know the pharmacology of. There have been drugs that have emerged, maybe we don't call them drugs, they're just substances that we don't really know the pharmacology of. We don't know if they're going to be stimulants. We don't know if they're going to be depressants. We don't know how they're going to affect the central nervous system. So we've kind of put them in this miscellaneous category. We have continued to see them over the years. They're drugs like Furanyl, UF-17, things that people may or may not have heard of. We don't see them. They're not sort of the sole cause of death. They're not things that are really of high priority, but we've seen them. So those go in that miscellaneous category. Fast. And the other thing that we recently just put into the miscellaneous category was actually metatomidine. So I'm sure people have heard that. Well, I'm sure people have heard that xylazine is in the fentanyl drug supply. And certainly metatomidine has now emerged in the fentanyl supply as well.
Almost everyone who is a medical listener will know of metatomidine because dexmedetomidine is a very common sedative agent that we use in the intensive care unit to keep people sedated. It's an alpha 2 agonist. I know metatomidine has been used in the veterinary literature for a long time, so that is really interesting.
Yeah, so that's something that doesn't really fall into one of those other four categories. It's something that technically fell under our NPS definition. We didn't want to exclude it out, so we included it. And the reason we did that was because in Europe, they included xylazine in their NPS definition. Mm-hmm. Xylazine, by 2018, was so common here in the United States, especially in Philadelphia, that we really didn't put it. We kind of viewed it more as a legacy adulterant rather than an NPS. So that's what falls in that miscellaneous category. So it's kind of a catch-all bucket of things that can have various types of different effects, but that don't fall into those stimulant, opioid, benzo, or synthetic cannabinoid categories.
Furanyl UF-17. I cannot. So we're finding stuff that we don't, it's not even this classic, like, oh, somebody bought a research chemical online. It's literally, we don't even know how it works yet. I like that we're at that tip of the spear. We're seeing stuff before we even know how it works. And that's a wonderful program to have. Actually, can you please help me understand how you're actually identifying these substances? So in the reports, you say comprehensive non-targeted data acquisition by gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, which I think a lot of people are familiar with, and then liquid chromatography, quadrupole time of flight mass spectrometry.
Yeah, so the difference between the two instruments, and really the difference is going to be on the mass spectrometry side. GCMS uses gas chromatography, so it uses a gas phase separation. Liquid chromatography uses a liquid phase separation. That part of it really isn't the exciting part. Really, the part that we put a lot more emphasis on is the mass spectrometry part. So in a GCMS, you're going to look for all masses between some sort of bounds. For us, you're going to generally look between, say, 50 mass units and 500 mass units. Every small molecule drug that we care about falls in that range.
Okay, that makes
sense. Carbon is 12 mass units. Hydrogen is one mass unit. Nitrogen is 14 mass units. So when you add them all together, they end up being a certain number of mass units. It's kind of like money. Like $1 is $1.
Yeah.
$20.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So in a GCMS, you're going to identify things, like I said, based on unit mass, 100, 151, 336.
Right.
And what that ends up sort of correlating to is really a chemical fingerprint. But again, that was all based on this unit mass resolution where the number is just a number. There is no decimal place. Hmm. If we transfer over to QTOF and other what are called high resolution accurate mass spectrometers, they have they acquire much more accurate mass data. So a lot of times we like to think carbon weighs 12, hydrogen weighs 1, oxygen weighs 16. But there's something called mass defect, and that there are actually numbers past that whole digit.
Right.
And that's what high resolution accurate mass relies on. It relies on that difference. And when you start to, a chemical formula has obviously more than one carbon, more than one hydrogen, it has many. When you add them all together and you get a significant difference there in those decimal places, and that's what QTOF and other HRMS instruments really hones in on and relies on. And so instead of a number being 336, you're talking about 336.1234.
Right.
When you get out that far, you can have a lot more, and when you have good accuracy out to those four decimal places, you have a lot better discriminating power between different numbers. And those numbers correlate back to the chemical formula. And then there's a whole bunch of things. What we're doing at our lab is we have an assay that we've developed. So no matter what, no matter if we know the drug exists or not, the data is going to be collected. The mass spectrometer is going to collect the fact that.
Yeah.
And then we can do a lot of cool things on the data processing side to go in and say, okay, well, does this match to a new standard I'm adding to the library database or whatnot? We've had a lot of success in using this approach. When we started out in 2018, I think our library database probably had 800 drugs in it. If that, actually probably less, probably like 500 or 600 drugs in it. Our library database now is at that 1200 drug mark. So we have 1200 drugs that when we detect them with our QTOF, we can confirm them and report them out.
QTOF, massive library, also able to discern to a much lower or a much smaller view. If it's like a microscope, you can go down to the 400 magnification on this one, as opposed to GCMS, you're going to like the 10 magnification in terms of the differences between two things. Does that sound right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it does bring up two different concepts. The first is specificity. So definitely QTOFs are more specific than GCMS is. The other, though, is sensitivity. And QTOFs are also more sensitive. So a QTOF is going to be able to pick up smaller amounts of drugs. Not only is it going to be able to distinguish things better, it's going to actually be able to detect smaller amounts.
At a way lower threshold. Okay.
So it's kind of both of those are leading into that microscope zooming in type of analogy.
Okay. Well, why don't we jump into what we're finding on this LC or on these QTOF analysis of drugs, of blood, and of postmortem samples. So in the April report, which was just released,
Hi folks, Toxo here. If you want to dive into the report yourself during the show, check the show notes for a link to this report, or head to cfsoe.org.
Q1 2024 trend report, and this is breaking down benzos, opioids, stimulants, hallucinogens, and synthetic cannabinoids, NPSs, so ones that are not traditional, that we're finding. And when we look at the benzodiazepine report, I'm seeing all sorts of interesting substances, adenosylam, finazolam, flualprazolam, and these appear to be almost entirely toxicology specimens. So that would be in our living samples, right? Or our deceased postmortem investigations. But by and large, the number one substance I'm seeing, and one that I've had a number of patients tell me they're using or withdrawing from, is bromazolam. So I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on how long you've been seeing that, maybe give us any background you have on bromazolam and if this is something that you think is sticking around.
Yeah. So, for the listeners who have, sort of known the NPS benzodiazepine market in the United States for the last decade, they'll probably remember that there used to be a lot of consistency in the market. 8 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, atezolam was king. It was the number one NPS benzo that we saw, and it was always around. And there didn't really ever look like anything was going to happen to atezolam. Probably about 4 or 5 years ago, flurpiridazolam came on the scene, and then you had for a number of years sort of this co-challenging for number one between atezolam and flurpiridazolam. And those were really the two big players in the NPS benzodiazepine market a few years ago. And then the market was really upended by the World Health Organization's scheduling of those two drugs internationally. That happened in March of 2022. And the way that that works is that the World Health Organization, because this is probably going to come up later on as well, the World Health Organization has an expert committee that evaluates sort of the risk of drugs. It's an international committee that has different scientists that serve on that committee. They write reports, and then eventually a group decides on whether those drugs should fall under the UN conventions, drug conventions or not. And they decided ultimately that they should. When WHO makes that decision, countries around the world that abide by the UN drug conventions have to follow suit and schedule those drugs. And the DEA did do that here in the United States. However, at that point, Etizolam and Flupirizolam were already going away. And that really opened the door for bromazolam. So getting back to your question about when bromazolam first started sort of coming on the scene, bromazolam, I think we probably identified first in 2020 or 2021, but its explosion in positivity happened as a direct result of the scheduling of flupirizolam and Etizolam. Relates to the point that it became overwhelmingly the predominant NPS benzodiazepine that we saw in mid late 2022, all throughout 2023, and now into 2024. And now the question is, well, how long will bromazolam stay around for? And the answer to that is not very long, because just in March of this year, WHO ruled that bromazolam will be international, or it was internationally scheduled. So we do expect bromazolam will now also go away this year, and we'll have a new benzodiazepine later this year and into next year that will become sort of the primary NPS benzodiazepine that we see on the NPS.
Fascinating. So all my patients who are coming in on bromazolam withdrawal, I might see more of that because they're going to run out of their bromazolam. And I believe bromazolam is a triazobenzodiazepine, which are kind of similar to the Xanax. And I could be wrong on that, so I'll fact check that. Oh, yeah.
That's correct. Yeah, it is correct. So bromazolam is alprazolam, but the chlorine is replaced with a bromine.
Oh, my gosh. That's fantastic. So, yeah. So alprazolam is well known, or at least there's plenty of case reports out there for having some of the most severe withdrawal because this specific structure could sometimes be refractory to other benzos. So there's case reports of alprazolam responding only to alprazolam. There's case reports of alprazolam withdrawal mimicking pheochromocytoma, which is this like horrible cancer that essentially makes you lose all this weight because you're secreting all these catecholamines. It looks like almost like we call it the hot, tacky, crazy toxidrome, but almost like a meth overdose where you're hot, sweaty, tachycardic, and, you know, kind of agitated. Alprazolam withdrawal can look really sympathetic, we call it, where you get too much fight or flight. So bromazolam is in that same class. I did not realize it was just a bromochlorine switch, alprazolam. So that could be concerning. I guess if the next one on the market isn't a triazolo, I wonder if we'll see more severe withdrawal because it might not be as treatable. That's it.
Yeah. So this is kind of hard to predict. The alprazolam analogs definitely seem, because flupirizolam was the same way, although flupirizolam was not the removal of the chlorine. I think it was just the addition of, but flupirizolam is very, very structurally similar to alprazolam as well.
Right.
So, I mean, that's kind of the trend. In that the alprazolam like analog are the ones that have been more common recently, likely due to they probably are the ones that have the higher potency, especially when you compare that to things like desalkylgadazepam, some of the ones that are structurally more related to diazepam, those are going to probably have your lower potencies compared to some of the alprazolam like analogs. So it's kind of hard to predict what the next big benzo is going to be. But I mean, there'll be something there to replace it. I think the one thing that I just want to mention in relation to NPS benzos is just a reminder that, maybe not a reminder, but just a point that there's really now two buckets of populations where we see these NPS benzos. We see them in counterfeit Xanax tablets. Mm-hmm. So people who think they're buying Xanax and it ends up being bromazolam and it's not alprazolam. The other bucket is in these benzo dope scenarios where the benzos, the NPS benzos specifically, are mixed in with fentanyl. So we do not see this. We do not see alprazolam and diazepam mixed in with fentanyl. We specifically see the NPS benzodiazepines mixed in with fentanyl. And it's the same reason why xylazine is being mixed in with fentanyl. It's you have these other CNS depressants that cause sedation that are being added in with fentanyl. It's very common in the Midwest for us to see these combinations. So of these high number of bromazolam cases we have, especially toxicology cases, I'd be willing to bet if we went back and looked at the co-occurrence with fentanyl is going to be very high. It's going to be greater than 50%, might even be greater than 70%. So you've got these two different buckets of why we're seeing these NPS benzos, and they are, I mean, sometimes they're overlapping populations. You have some people who are using opioids and then using benzodiazepines separately, but then you have that population who is using benzodope, regardless of whether or not they want to be or not. That's just
right.
That they're using, and they're consuming opioids and benzodiazepines at the same time because that is the opioid product that they're buying.
Yeah, that's no surprise to most listeners that the illicitly sourced substances are frequently contaminated with all sorts of adulterants. I remember I just looked at a DEA or a report of the fentanyl M30 tablets, 12 different ones seized at the border in one day, and they had 5 different substances apiece. All had fentanyl, p-fluoro, some had xylazine, some had phenobarbital. It was just kind of wild, all the different things that are in there. And that's a great point to add here. When you're looking at the samples, the forensic samples, for the drug product samples, you're saying it's usually pressed Xanax, like fake Xanax, or potentially a fake pressed fentanyl or fentanyl powder. You're never getting like a raw vial that says bromazolam on it.
Usually not. Yeah.
Okay. I have a friend who works in an emergency department in Denver, and he texted me a picture of a patient who came in but the substance the patient had, which was literally a vial that said bromazolam on it. And I was like, what is going on? So some people know, it looks like actually one that you would draw up in a syringe, but kind of a, way to dispense it. But some people potentially are even just buying this online. And you said it's currently unscheduled in the United States? Or I actually don't.
So yes, technically. This is though where this gets into a bit of a gray area. So it will have to be scheduled by DEA as they follow suit on WHO's international scheduling. Although, I mean, if you ask the DEA, they may say that it falls under the Analog Act.
Right. So it's already an analog that they could schedule. So the 1986 Federal Analog Act, I think basically anything that is a derivative of a scheduled drug already, they can claim is scheduled. But that's it gets really confusing what actually falls under that.
Correct. That's why it gets to be a very, very. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's really helpful. So for opioids, let's look at the 5 most commonly found substances. I have orthomethylfentanyl, N-pyrrolidino, etanidazine. I think I butchered that. And then something I'm more familiar with, metanidazine and protonidazine. And then we have carfentanil. Obviously, it looks like we're seeing a huge amount of fentanyl analogs. I am seeing one change compared to what I'm used to seeing, or at least in the last reports, and I could be wrong. Parafluorofentanil was really big recently. And I'm not even seeing it on this report. Now it's orthomethylfentanyl. Is that because it's been put into the traditional category or because it's not showing up anymore?
Yeah, so this is one of the questions that is kind of a thorn in our side. And it is the question of, well, is there ever a time that an NPS is no longer an NPS? We had this question with etisalam because etisalam was around for so long.
Right.
And we've had this question with fluorofentanyl. So we made the decision last year to start categorizing fluorofentanyl with fentanyl for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that we have so many cases of fluorofentanyl that it blows the rest of these out of the water. In Q1, we had 330 cases of fluorofentanyl, and for orthomethylfentanyl was at 49. So if we put fluorofentanyl on this graphic, you pretty much lose and almost don't even see the rest of them because the bar for fluorofentanyl is so large. So that's one of the pieces. The other piece is that, and I often say, I use the kind of analogy of if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. I use that for NPS. If there are just some of those things where I feel like it acts like an NPS, if it seems like an NPS, it's an NPS, and just feels like fluorofentanil doesn't fit that mold anymore. A lot of the NPS that we see are drugs that are being synthesized in labs overseas, being shipped to the United States, being these days mixed in with sort of more traditional drug supplies. They may be purchased by people who are experimenting with drugs. The NPS market is a very different market than your traditional drug supplies, although NPS do appear in traditional drug supplies.
Right, like the benzos.
With the benzos. Fluorofentanil, it's a whole different ballgame. Fluorofentanil really is it's being manufactured in Mexico by the cartels, really as a result of the scheduling of fentanyl precursors. There's been a lot of legislation to try and curb the production of fentanyl, and that actually led to the rise in the production of fluorofentanyl in Mexico. So because of that, fluorofentanil really has a stronger connection with fentanyl and feels more like a traditional drug in that sense than it does like an NPS. And that's kind of why we've slowly pushed it more towards being with fentanyl.
Sure.
From the NPS. So
that makes sense.
So yeah, well, so that's why that's not on here.
That makes sense. Okay. So for the listeners, p-fluorofentanil is probably the most common fentanyl analog that we're seeing beyond fentanyl, which is not an analog because that's fentanyl. It maybe that is good because it does appear there's such limited data. But if you look at the binding affinity data, the receptor stimulatory data, and the rodent data, it appears to be like maybe a third as potent as fentanyl. But, yeah. So maybe that is good that it's not fentanyl in the supply. We're getting something less potent, but I don't know that we're seeing any less overdose deaths from it. But anyways, if we can dive into then orthomethylfentanyl we're seeing. Orthomethyl.
Yeah, so all of that orthomethylfentanyl is actually from samples from Canada, interestingly, and specifically from provinces out west, mostly from British Columbia. So for whatever reason, we're currently seeing this weird increase of orthomethylfentanyl out in the Vancouver area and some of the surrounding areas there. That hasn't been a problem yet here in the United States. So as it relates to fentanyl analogs, one thing I should say is that when the DEA moved to control fentanyl analogs in the spring of 2018, it had a dramatic effect on eradicating fentanyl analogs from the supply in the United States. As a result of DEA's core structure scheduling of fentanyl analogs, it pretty much wiped them all out.
Wow.
And that's also, again, how fluorofentanyl doesn't really fit that mold. And that it kind of goes against that pattern. And orthomethylfentanyl right now is, again, also kind of going against that pattern, and that it's really not the United States, it's Canada.
It's Canada.
So when it comes to fentanyl analogs, we really don't see, with the exception of carfentanil and it popping up across the country, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more in a moment. With these two exceptions that kind of go against that rule, the DEA's scheduling of fentanyl analogs and then China following suit really did eradicate fentanyl analogs from the supply. And that's what opened the door to the nitazine analogs and this proliferation and what is now sort of a potpourri of nitazine analogs that we see across the country.
Well, we'll dive right into those. So after orthomethylfentanyl, our next most common is N-pyrrolidino, etanitazine, metanitazine, and protonitazine, and those constitute the next three most commonly identified. And when you look at DEA analysis of, you know, seized drugs, you see very similar things. So if you haven't heard about the nitazines yet, this is a good opportunity to learn about them. They are out there. Isotonitazine and metotonitazine were really big in the Midwest for a little while. I know I had 7 isotonitazine deaths right in my own city. So you kind of gave us a little bit of background of why we're seeing them. I know they were all largely research chemicals from the 1960s from a company who was trying to bring them to market. Is there any other, and it seems like they were unscheduled for quite a while and people were just buying them online. Is there any other information or background you wanted to provide on them or anything of note you think is interesting?
Yeah, so I think that the mindset that people should have as it relates to the nitazine analogs is that it is kind of very eerily similar to the fentanyl analogs. They are just completely different drugs, and there is sort of key differences to note. But when you look at previously with the fentanyl analogs. You had fentanyl as your prototype. Then you had all of these other analogs that emerged as slight chemical modifications to fentanyl. And that's what we're seeing now with the nitazine analogs. The prototypical drug is etonitazine. And you're right in saying that that was developed back for really in investigational medicinal chemistry purposes, never brought to market, although it was scheduled along with clonidazine and some others. One other, I guess, a while back. Oh, no, just the two of those were scheduled a while back. Never brought to market. But then as fentanyl analogs went away, etonitazine became the prototypical drug that we can now modify and make all these other different new nitazine analogs. So the first was isotonitazine. And early on with the nitazine analogs, what we saw was that we would see one emerge, we would see the DEA schedule it, and we would see it go away. That has changed recently. So early on, we saw isotonitazine emerge, the DEA scheduled it, it went away. We saw morphine emerge, although that was not a nitazine analog. DEA scheduled it, it went away. We saw metanitazine emerge, the DEA scheduled it. It did go away originally, but has since come back. And now what we see is that some of these are scheduled, but they are persisting and proliferating in different areas. We've got kind of this... this, like I said, the sort of potpourri of different different nitazine analogs. So chemistry-wise, like the fentanyl analogs, you've got prototypical etonitazine and all these different chemical modifications. The difference, though, from the fentanyl analogs was that for the majority of the fentanyl analogs, a lot of them were, it was kind of a 50-50 mix. Actually, it probably wasn't. It was probably, I mean, the majority of the fentanyl analogs, a lot of them were actually less potent than fentanyl.
Right.
Some were similar potency to fentanyl. The nitazine analogs, the majority of them are more potent than fentanyl. Some 10 times more potent, 20 times more potent.
Yeah. Etonitazine, yeah. I thought that one was like 20 times more. Yeah. When you look at the receptor binding affinity data, it's, yeah.
I think N-pyrrolidino etonitazine is something like 40 times more potent if you look at the in vitro potency data.
Wow.
Well, again, while they're similar from a chemistry scaffolding perspective to fentanyl analogs, they're completely different in that the majority of them are more potent than fentanyl. But this is where the market is now. This is kind of the new NPS opioid market. And yeah, it's gotten to the point where DEA has scheduled a bunch of these. Metanitazine is scheduled. For whatever reason, though, we continue to see these weird cyclic patterns of metanitazine. We see increases in positivity and decreases, increases and decreases, increases and decreases. We're not sure why. That kind of goes against a lot of the other patterns we've seen with NPS where something's scheduled and it goes away.
So I see on your report here that, you know, a lot of the detection of the nitazines or nitazines are from toxicology specimens. So that's in a human, but there's also a fair amount of drug material. Do you recall like what kind of material you're seeing this in? Is this pressed tablets? Is this just powders that you guys are that are being sent in?
Yeah, so that's one thing that has actually changed at all. So isotonitazine first emerged in the drug supply in 2019. Early on, isotonitazine and metanitazine, when those first emerged in Illinois and Tennessee, they were in powders by themselves. Well, not by themselves. They were in powders with NPF benzos, with phenylpropazolam or tislam at the time. But they were not with other opioids. And that's how we commonly saw the nitazines originally. Fast forward, though, to today. Actually, the majority of the time we see nitazines now, they're actually mixed in with fentanyl. And they're actually at quite low levels compared to fentanyl. So we may have fentanyl in a powder at 10%, and then isotonitazine in there, or N-diethyl isotonitazine in there at 1%, or less than 1%. So that's kind of what the drug materials look like. And it's actually really more than that. It's usually fentanyl, xylazine, N-diethyl isotonitazine, promazolam, fluoxetine, and maybe whatever else can fit into that powder. So it is. These are very complex drug mixtures. From the toxicologist perspective, this is another thorn in my side, is that we often get asked, well, at what point do these drugs become significant or not? Is a fentanyl at 10% and an N-diethyl isotonitazine at 0.5%? At what point does that nitazine analog
become more
significance pharmacologically? Yeah. And I don't have an answer to that. I don't think anybody has an answer to that. And that's what's really become the challenge. I mean, the same is true with benzos as well. At what point is there so little bromazolam in an opioid powder that it's probably not going to create sedation in a human?
Right. And we're running into these things. We can detect things at such sensitive parameters with TOF and all these, right? That, you know, are we detecting things that in reality aren't really playing a massive role, especially with these novel things that, you know, we'd have zero standardized reference ranges for what implies toxicity, what doesn't. That's a great point. Well, I'm glad we're at least seeing them, though. You know, it helps us understand what the actual landscape is looking at. You brought it up already. We have to talk about carfentanil. How often are we seeing this? I mean, this, I guess it never, you could argue that it's not an NPS because it's been around forever. But
that is true.
It's popping up. I see right here on your report, it is, you know, in this quarter, there was 5 specimens of carfentanil, 4 of them in people and 1 in a drug material. So can you comment at all on first, actually, what drug materials are you seeing this in? Is this another one that's frequently seen with powders mixed with other opioids, or is it kind of standalone?
Just to clarify, 3 people, or sorry, 4 people and 3 powders.
Oh, sorry. I'm zoomed out on my screen. I need some glasses. Okay. Yeah. Powders.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right in that carfentanil has been around probably longer, definitely longer than I've been alive. it's had its outbreaks here and there. And yeah, it's gotten to the point of, right, could you declassify it as an NPS? The one thing to really note off the bat about carfentanil is that the current carfentanil outbreak, or if you want to call it an outbreak, is different than the carfentanil outbreaks of the past. In the past, we would see, for example, huge carfentanil outbreak in Cleveland, Ohio, where you had powders that were just carfentanil. You had 20, 30, 40 people dead. It was truly an outbreak of carfentanil. And it was kind of centralized, localized, sort of, but really kind of zoned in on one area. That's really not the case now. Right now, we're seeing carfentanil across the country. And we're seeing it with fentanyl almost always right now. So very similar to what we're seeing with the nitazine analogs, we're seeing fentanyl and a little bit of carfentanil. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of different ways to kind of interpret this. My interpretation of it is that, kind of, it's one of those eerie things like, well, it kind of feels like fluorofentanyl, right?
Right.
When you have carfentanil that widespread across the country, that's not coming from one guy buying this from China or one person sourcing this from somewhere.
Yeah.
There's no way that you've got dealers in, or manufacturers, dealers, people making up drugs in Maine and Rhode Island and Illinois and California and Florida all doing the same thing. It's just a very weird scenario. So the good news behind all of this is that we're not seeing like high purity carfentanil powders.
Right.
We're seeing it. It's usually pretty low amounts, again, with fentanyl. But yeah, again, it's across the country.
And it looks, and I'm just looking at the kind of the trend of your quarterly report, you know, 2022, there was a big jump, 4% positivity, it looks like. But then at least it did seem to die down a little bit and it's coming back now. But at least we're not in the worst that it's been. Hopefully we're not going back to that trajectory. But that is really fascinating. So yeah. Co-formulated with fentanyl, usually a powder. That is that it's like the boogeyman out there. There's, you know, carfentanil, although now that we have potentially, you know, at least in vitro, etanitazine analogs that are 40 times as potent as fentanyl, it might not be the only thing to care about anymore. This always brings up all these questions about naloxone resistance when we start hearing about carfentanil being in the area. I have a lot of, although there's some good animal data that you can reverse a pretty large chunk of carfentanil with 2 milligrams of naloxone. So I don't know that I worry about it too much, but it's always something that gets talked about and with good reason because it's so potent. Well, that was really enlightening to learn about. Nitazines are out there, orthomethylfentanyl, the fentanyl analogs. We're still seeing carfentanil. There's one on here.
Dipionum.
Dipionum. I hope the listeners are going to enjoy how bad I am at pronouncing these. Dipionum. What is that? I've never even heard of that. Is that
it's an opioid as well. If you look at it, its structure will look a lot more like something like methadone, than fentanyl or oxycodone or any of your other opioids. It's one of those rare ones that we see here and there. Its activity is pretty low. One thing that, from a forensic toxicology standpoint, that is always fascinating to me is that when we quantify a drug, we can usually tell pretty well if it's a potent drug or not. And dipionone is one of those good examples. Like when we have an overdose case and the concentration is 2,000 nanograms per mil, that's a pretty good indicator to us that it's not a very potent drug. Yeah. Where you sort of juxtapose that with protonitazine, you have a death at 2 nanograms per mil.
Right.
I mean, it's not to say that someone couldn't use sort of a mega dose and still get to that high of a concentration with something that's ultra potent. But dipionone's pretty low in potency relative to some of these others. And you actually see, as you go up the list, something like metrodesnitazine, dipionone, AP-238, etodesnitazine, all of those are actually quite low in potency. I think there's a reason why we see those less commonly.
Right.
One is probably because they're less desirable. And the other is that because they have lower potency, they just might be less implicated in the types of samples that we analyze.
Right. So it's a little bit of sampling bias. You're not going to see people die from it. So you're not as likely to get or become intoxicated from it so severely to go to an ED. So you're less likely to actually pick up those samples. But those are the people I care about. So it is good to know what's in there. Well, I'm going to have to push this forward. We got to get through two more things, and I have so many more questions. So let's jump into stimulants and hallucinogens. This section here has so many substances I have never really even imagined thinking about. So the most commonly identified stimulant/hallucinogen we're looking at, N,N-dimethylpentylone, as well as pentylone. This, we're seeing some normal things. I'm seeing some cathinones, methcathinone, chloromethcathinone. I believe some ketamine derivatives, deoxymethoxetamine, 2F2-oxo-PCE. I believe that is a PCP derivative. Does that sound about right? Or
looks a little bit more like ketamine, actually.
Okay.
Even though it's called 2-fluorotrioxo-PCE, it does look a little more like ketamine. Although ketamine and PCP are structurally.
They're derivatives. Yeah. Ketamine is the ketone amine PCP derivative. Yeah. So, all right. They're all sort of maybe NMDA receptor antagonist stuff. Okay. But let's talk about pentylone. I'm seeing this a lot on here. What is going on with pentylone?
Yeah. So dimethylpentylone is the primary synthetic cathinone that we see. And pentylone is its metabolite.
Okay.
So that's why we see that commonly. And we include that in there because we see it so commonly. So, N,N-dimethylpentylone, I'll just call it dimethylpentylone because
yeah, you
say without the N's, is really just the next wave of the most prevalent cathinone. So, for those who have kept up with the cathinone trends over the last decade, you had methylone, then you had butylone, then you had N-ethylpentylone, then you had eutylone, and now you have dimethylpentylone. The thing you'll notice in there is that these are all the lones or the Y-L-O-N-E's. They're the beta-ketomethylenedioxycathinones. So they are the kind of cross-hybrid of MDMA mix cathinones.
Right.
Not like the hexadrones or the drones don't have the methylene dioxy group.
Yeah. So those are the straight amphetamine. These are the methylene deoxy amphetamine sort of cathinone, not amphetamine, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's the amphetamine analogs. So the ones that have both the methylene deoxy group and the beta ketone are generally the ones that are the most prevalent for whatever reason. So like alpha PVP was one that was also in that category.
Oh, yeah.
So something like chloromethcathinone, methylmethcathinone, those have the beta ketone, but don't have the methylene deoxy group. Those have been very common in Europe, but for whatever reason, those have not been very common in the United States. In the United States, we like the methylene deoxy group and the beta ketone. So that's why we like the loans here. So dimethylpentylone is just is just the next cathinone in line. Similar to bromazolam, WHO put this on the list for international scheduling in March. Mm. So we do expect this to be replaced later this year. And that's kind of why our numbers, we think why our numbers are sort of going down currently. But yeah, so that's that. You'll see Utalon is still on the list. Utalon, again, was the prior most common cathinone that people will probably remember from a couple of years ago. That was internationally scheduled as well, and that fell off. And so is the cycle that just keeps going for it.
Right. The ever evolving arms race of analogs and scheduling. Quick question, I guess, in terms of drug material samples, this PCE/ketamine derivative or this 3-methyl PCP, are we seeing these more as powders, liquids? Is this people buying things from in a branded product from a head shop, or is this like?
So 2-fluoro-2-oxo-PCE has been kind of weird. So the 3-methyl PCP was actually a case where somebody had purchased that online. They purchased it and actually got what they purchased, which is kind of rare in these days. Ended up being a clinical case, someone who presented to an emergency department. We're actually working up kind of the rest of that case as we speak. But 2-fluoro-2-oxo-PCE has been a weird one. We've seen it in a variety of different scenarios. We've seen it in scenarios where it's kind of masquerading as ketamine. As you may know, and listeners may know, there's been this massive sort of resurgence of ketamine in the United States. Recreational use of ketamine and sort of the nightclub rave type scenes. But we've seen it in that scenario. We've also seen it mixed with fentanyl, which I suspect is just a mistake. I'm not really sure that anyone is purposefully trying to add hallucinogen to their fentanyl. I think they got a white powder that they maybe thought was xylazine.
Yeah.
So those are kind of some of those weird scenarios that we've seen. But we have seen, we actually did have a death that was just a massive amount of 2-fluoro-2-oxo-PCE.
Wow.
And nothing else. It was truly a sole 2-fluoro-2-oxo-PCE death and the true overdose type scenario. So that's one we're keeping our eye on as it kind of continues to bounce around and increase a bit in positivity.
Interesting. I appreciate the additional context on this rise of the newer bath salts and their derivatives. I think that leaves us time to jump into, unless there's anything else you want to comment on in the cathinone /
decision. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think we can get on to what is my favorite class, the synthetic cannabinoids.
The SynCans. Oh boy. I wish, can they please just, I love saying them, but I'll never remember a single one of them. Panaka, Fubanaka, Abanaka, Ganaka, Naka. So here we are in the synthetic cannabinoids. It's looking like, and if I look at this trend chart, it looks like an abstract painting where someone threw a bunch of I've got lines up and down and all over the place. So it seems like the trends are kind of all over. So can tell us why it's your favorite. What's going on in this market?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the synthetic cannabinoids have been a really interesting class for us to study is that they're challenging. They're challenging from a chemistry perspective. They don't play well in the lab. So we're able to detect benzos, opioid stimulants, and hallucinogens really well all together really easily. And synthetic cannabinoids are kind of all on an island on their own. They need their own dedicated methods. They need their own sort of special attention. And I think just from a chemist perspective, that really intrigues me. And the other part of it is that a lot of labs say, well, it's too difficult to do. We're not going to do it. So we're like, oh, well, we'll do it because it's fun. But also of recent, there's been so many changes to the markets. The synthetic cannabinoid market of 2024 and really of 2023 is just so different from the past. So I'll try and give, in interest of time, a very quick rundown. So a decade ago, synthetic cannabinoids emerged on the recreational drug supply sometime around 2010 or slightly thereafter. About a decade ago, we were commonly seeing head shops selling these foil packages that had these pictures on them with cartoons.
Right.
They had plant materials in them. That was a common way people were getting synthetic cannabinoids. And the market is no longer like that. I mean, I'm sure people know that those head shops don't exist. Well, those head shops exist. They're just selling semi-synthetic cannabinoids, these cannabinoid products that are derived from CBD at this point.
Right. Delta 8, selling, Delta 10. Yeah.
Right. Delta 8, Delta 10, THC, THCP, right, all right, these right. other analogs. The synthetic cannabinoid products in there have really changed. There was a point where they went to being in foil packages that had no sort of pictures on them, but the market was really upended in 2021, I think it was now. So really out of nowhere, in July of 2021, China announced that they were going to ban synthetic cannabinoids based on structural class. So it's very similar to what the United States did with fentanyl analogs. However, they said, well, it's not just one scaffold. We're going to say we're going to ban five different scaffolds and all of these different modifications. So China put that ban in place, and the labs in China stopped making synthetic cannabinoids. So there was a couple year period thereafter. 2022 and into 23 was a really weird time for synthetic cannabinoids. We saw the emergence of drugs that were not active. We saw the emergence of drugs that were just really weird structures. We had to give them very weird names. If anyone ever saw those, the oxazids, the fubiatas, the things that just looked different. Flash forward now to really the end of 2023 into 2024, the market found a way to respond to that China ban. And what happened was, well, now, so the China ban did not include the precursors to the synthetic cannabinoids. So now labs in China can make the precursors, which essentially are the synthetic cannabinoids without their tail. They can ship them somewhere, add on the tail, and the synthetic cannabinoids can be made. So that's actually what we're seeing now. So we're seeing a shift back to
the regular
MDMB, MDMB, fluorine panaca, the panacas, the binacas, the fubinacas, all of those things that we saw before, but from a different chemistry perspective, which again, from a chemist's side, is really interesting to me. So that's where we are now. And that's why the trend plot looks so weird, because there's just been a lot of weirdness going on in the middle. One thing that's been consistent for the last couple of years is that MDMB fluorine panaca has been the most common synthetic cannabinoid we've seen. Again, that's the reason we've seen it most commonly. That was different. It used to be that that was synthesized in China itself, but now it's that the precursor is synthesized in China and the final product is made elsewhere. So
Where else? Where is it made? Do we have an idea of where it's coming from? New Zealand?
Well, that's a good question. I actually don't. I don't know. Okay. That's the information that we're trying to figure out. Whether that's in the United States or whether it's in a different country,
interesting,
is to be determined. But it does feel like the synthetic cannabinoid market is coming back a little bit. So I'm located right outside of Philadelphia. I remember back just 5 years ago when Philadelphia had a sort of roaring K2 market.
Oh, yeah.
Philadelphia was known for its K2 market, K2 everywhere, and that has gone away. It pretty much disappeared. It will be interesting to see if any of that could ever come back. It'll be interesting to see if some of that changes. A lot of the samples that we get nowadays are samples linked to jail and prison overdoses. That's why we have a lot of drug materials in this subcategory. So we test a lot of paper products, paper strips, greeting cards, letters, papers that are going into jails that are suspected to contain synthetic cannabinoids. So that's where a big portion of our samples come for synthetic cannabinoids, and we'll go into our trend reports here. And that's kind of where a big portion of our focus has been, in trying to work with different public health departments to not only do the testing to figure out what synthetic cannabinoids are there, but to help push that messaging and that. Because one of the challenges that we've seen is that you could have five people standing around, all five people smoke the paper, only one person dies. We're trying to figure out why is that. We're doing some research now to figure out, is it hotspots? Is it
right distribution of the actual, like, within the material? Right. Yeah.
There's also been other really weird scenarios where fentanyl has been on these papers that we've gotten. So we're trying to figure all of that out, but so that's kind of the synthetic cannabinoid market in a nutshell. They still exist. They're still out there. They're not something that you'll encounter just by going about your normal everyday business, or at least for us.
Yeah.
We certainly do detect synthetic cannabinoids in the ACMT, Fentalog, and DOT studies from time to time, but it's not like bromazolam. It's not like M-pyrrolidino adenidazine. It's not like dimethylpentylone.
A little harder to
find. Certainly more of the needle in the haystack type of
interest. Do you have a hard cutoff at?
I do not.
That's great, because I realize I don't either. We could go a little bit past, because I do have
some questions.
Since we do have some time, I would love to actually learn a little bit more, because synthetic cannabinoids are a clinical or medical toxicologist nightmare, because we never know if it's in there. see people sometimes intubated in the ICU for 5 days because they can have half-lives of, you know, multiple days and be 800 times as potent as THC and full agonists as the CB1 receptor. So many issues with them. And there's always a new one that we do not know anything about. So I have a lot of actually vested interest in learning more about them. First up, you said you had to name some things weird because we'd never seen it. And if this is going to be too confusing, just tell me. But is there an easy way to understand the naming conventions of these cannabinoids? Because I am always perplexed as to where they come from.
So easy, maybe not. However, there is a systematic approach that we use. So unlike every other drug class that we've talked about, there are some rules as to why bromazolam got its name. There are some rules as to why we named N-pyrrolidinoadenitazine the way we named it.
Right.
However, all of those other drug classes do not have the systematic approach that we have with synthetic cannabinoids. So when you look at a synthetic cannabinoid name, there's generally different parts to it, and they're usually separated by the dashes. And depending on those different parts, they relate to different portions of the molecule.
Structural frameworks. Okay.
Right. So something like MDMB fluorine panaca, the MDMB, so there's also different portions of the synthetic cannabinoid molecule. You have the head group, you have the linker and core group, and then you have the tail group. So MDMB refers to the head group. The P in panaca refers to the pentyl tail. Then the 4-ene refers to the double bond on the pentyl tail. And the inaca refers to the core and the linker. So synthetic cannabinoids, once you understand, it's almost like deciphering a code.
Right.
Once you understand the letter code, like I can look at a name and already picture a structure.
Right.
I can't
do that. It's like any chemical structure of, you know, you have the language to describe the true chemical structure.
I can share a poster with you that we made for a conference earlier this year that we put together kind of a graphic that shows how this all comes together.
I would love that. I can post it in the show notes. Personally, I would love to have that. Another question that I have, were you ever picking up Brodificum in any of your samples? So in 20, when it was it? Well, the first outbreak, I think, was 2017. I can't remember. I know it was right here in Milwaukee. I had patients coming into the emergency department bleeding out of all these orifices. And I'd be like, which one did you smoke? We would, you know, so there's the Brodificum contaminated synthetic cannabinoids, which I assume most of the listeners have heard of. They were quite a headache because it's very hard to keep someone's INR less than, you know, 2 for over a year with vitamin K. Yeah, and we see this pop up every once in a while. So how often were you seeing Brodificum, and are you still seeing it? Have you seen any samples recently?
We were detecting Brodificum and actually some of the other super warfarins or anticoagulants, whatever you want to call it, during those times, about the 2017 outbreak. And then there was the more recent outbreak that was in
Florida, I think.
2022 sometime.
Yeah.
More recently. The challenge with that testing is that it does require, for us, kind of a dedicated test. It's not something that we're going to see during our general synthetic cannabinoid screening. And it's not a test that we're going to perform on all of our samples. Something that we do more in kind of for cause scenarios.
Yeah.
So yeah, we actually had a really interesting case out of Tennessee back in, I think it was actually in 20, I think we got the case in like 2018. Where we had a case where an individual died, but he had what's considered like a trophy case. He had over 200 foil packets of all of the synthetic cannabinoids that he had consumed.
Oh, wow.
That he kept the trash instead of throwing them away. And we were able to actually test all of those and see that of the 200, there were like 10 or 20 packets that contained Brodificum.
Huh.
We're able to show that he was actually exposed to Brodificum multiple times over like this extended period of time.
But all the same kind of brand, or they were different?
No.
Okay.
All different packages, all different brands, all different synthetic cannabinoids.
It was
really interesting.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that because I just don't think anyone ever does that. I don't think anyone would. And they were all empty packages. So we had to swab the insides.
Right. Like, yeah. Who keeps the package of every little substance that they've used? That's interesting. That is pretty fascinating. Well, hey, I understand it's probably laborious to do so, but if you want to be the first alert that Brodificum is still out there, I guarantee you we would all be thrilled to hear from you if you guys start testing every product for Brodificum.
we would see it in the product. Like when we're testing drug materials, we would see it by GCMS and by it's in the toxicology side that we wouldn't see it routinely.
That side, we'll already know if they
exactly. And that's where we would rely more on the relationship with the medical toxicologists and the clinical folks to say, "Hey, let's do this additional testing."
Interesting. So your drug product testing, you would see if one of these SynCans was showing up with Brodificum. That's great to know. I'm happy to know that. So we have not
recently, to my knowledge.
That's good. That is good. Surely. Yeah, it just still baffles me how it even happens in the first place and why this. But
I will say that it was really hopeful in the outbreak, and again, whatever that was, 2021 or 2022, that most recent outbreak in Florida, was really hopeful that we were going to get an answer as to why. And it only confused me even more. There are so many theories.
Yeah.
So many that there are some that make sense and some that don't make sense, that it is like almost confusing to even.
Which ones do you think don't make sense? I would be very curious to hear your perspective because I think you'd be very knowledgeable on it. I know there's some have suggested it's actually a synthesis error because they're like these high, heterocyclic compounds. You actually could see some similarities between the compounds. So maybe they were trying to make this and they accidentally made a little bit of Brodificum too. But I don't know. Like, what do you think doesn't make sense?
The two that I think that are definitely the most questionable, the one is the enhanced effects to make the synthetic cannabinoids more euphoric.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that too. That
I think that's a bit questionable just because of the fact.
Does it? Like what? Right. I've heard something about too, like an enzyme effect trying to enhance its like pharmacokinetic, like how long it lasts, but they all last way too long. So I don't know.
Yeah, and part of that was something like one of the theories was like getting drug to the brain faster or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
So many different theories. The other one was there's this theory that the core structure of the super warfarins is similar enough to the synthetic cannabinoids that they felt like that was actually going that could be a CB1 agonist.
Huh. Oh, that they were like they're like, oh yeah, it'll work just by itself.
Right, that it essentially would be like an additive effect at CB1.
Huh. So all the rats that we're killing are just getting high before they.
Right. So that led us to start reaching out to our pharmacology colleagues to be like, hey, can you run Brodificum through your CB1 assay? And they were like, why? And we were like, because this is what people are claiming. So yeah, I mean, some of those.
Toxo here. Turns out some people actually studied this after the theory came about, and it's been confirmed Brodificum is definitely not a CB1 agonist. A link to that study is in the show notes. Back to the show.
I wish I knew why a lot of these different drug combinations come up. I mean, there's like the xylazine and fentanyl makes sense to me. You went from a product like heroin to fentanyl, where you've got more euphoria but shorter acting. People felt like they wanted to make fentanyl feel more like heroin, add something on the back to create sedation. That logic in that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Make fentanyl feel more like heroin by adding xylazine, by adding benzos, by adding whatever.
Yeah.
Some of these other theories of like why you would add, like when we were seeing synthetic cannabinoids laced into fentanyl, like that was very weird. And we saw that several times in Philadelphia. To the point that it's like, is there like a drug user, not a drug user, is there like a drug manufacturer forum that I'm not aware of? You go on there and they're like, hey, try this combination. We think it's going to be the best.
Yeah.
Because that is, there's like, yeah, fentanyl and synthetic cannabinoids, Brodificum and synthetic cannabinoids.
Yeah.
We've seen cathinones and synthetic cannabinoids.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare.
Straight onto plant material.
Oh, great.
So, like, are these mistakes?
That's a six-day ICU admission.
Right. Or is there, like, this secret forum that people think that these are going to be the best combinations? I don't know.
I got to assume some of it is, you know, the reason why every package says this was made in a facility that contains nuts. You know, these are not highly sophisticated mixing processes going on. You have one blender and you sell two different drugs. Sometimes they go in the same blender on, you know, afterwards and you pick them up. But then there is obviously sometimes there's intentional, right? So it's,
well, it feels like the Berdificum addition definitely felt intentional.
Yeah, that feels very like, is it malicious? There's so many questions,
right?
I don't know. Well, I appreciate your perspective on that as someone who's been spending a lot of time and has an in-depth understanding of it. I do have a one more question. So we've talked about benzos, we've talked about opioids, new stimulants, and the synthetic cathinones that are still prevalent. So we with the boom in the psychedelic market, with a lot of places legalizing psilocybin, we actually did a whole podcast on with talking to some psilocybin researchers. If any of the listeners are interested, I think it was episode 24, one of my old pharmacy school professors who now takes people down into a basement and gives them psilocybin and studies the effects. It's really, and I mean, I'm hugely excited about the potential for psilocybin if used appropriately and correctly and with, you know, right manufacturing. Everyone is excited about those things, but we're seeing sort of this other industry pop up alongside this. Facebook seems to think that I want to buy all sorts of commercially labeled quote unquote magic mushroom bars, probably because the amount of things that I Google through my job. So I get all these ads for them. And we even get calls about these through the Poison Center where kids are getting into these things that are labeled as mushroom bars. Some of them do contain psilocybin, I'm finding, but some of them contain things like when they submit these bars for analysis, you see 5-ACO-DMT in there and all these other, in, you know, kind of unique tryptamine psychedelics. I didn't notice any tryptamines on the hallucinogen report for this. Do you guys see tryptamines like DMT, or are those considered traditional? You know, am I going to start seeing like fluoropsilocybin show up on the market someday? Like, I'm just curious if that's incorporated.
So and we do see dimethyltryptamine for sure. We just don't characterize it as an NPS, so it actually removed off of here. But we have had several cases of DMT recently. Yeah, the whole psychedelic market is rather interesting. I will say, from a lab perspective, anything that is in a food or something that is supposed to be eaten or anything that's in like a lotion or weird material is usually really difficult for us to analyze. So like when we get these mushroom chocolate bars, they are like, we'd rather just throw them away than test them. We don't. We go through the process, but the process is difficult. You're sitting there and you're like breaking the chocolate bar apart.
Yeah.
Try and find the pieces of mushrooms to like harvest them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Cause it's not something, it's not like a powder where there's fentanyl in it. So yeah, they're very difficult to analyze. And, one of the challenges analytically for us is that some of these products do contain quite small amounts of these different drugs. So that can be challenging when it comes to the toxicology side. We just historically have always seen low numbers for hallucinogens, for NPS hallucinogens. And I think there's really two sides to that. The first side is that we really don't get a lot of drug materials. Like, we don't get a lot of blotter tabs. So we don't see a lot of the LSD analogs. We don't get a lot of mushroom hallucinogen type samples.
Can I clarify, like, so this is maybe a sampling bias of the CSFRE. Is there another group that is getting that? And this is probably kind of throughout, most people are not picking up these.
Well, I think that they're the proportion of those that are used compared to the proportion of opioid powders that are used is just
right. Yeah, yeah.
I think some of that, that's another one, like the synthetic cannabinoids, that's another one where you kind of got to go hunt and like find. That's not just something that's going to randomly crawl across your desk.
Yeah.
So there's some effort that needs to be put in there. The other side to it too is on the toxicology side. There aren't as many adverse events with some of these psychedelics as there are with the other drugs. If bromazolam was not commonly found with fentanyl, we probably would not have as many cases of bromazolam.
Interesting. If I think about the amount of patients I see in the emergency department for a psychedelic related issue versus opioids, you know, stimulants, it's, you know, astronomically not psychedelics that are so that makes a lot of sense.
All those different factors kind of play into why we don't see a lot of the psychedelics. We've had a lot of folks reach out to us over the years and say, well, because there's this kind of booming psychedelics market, whether it's new psychedelics that are being synthesized and researched for their medicinal purposes, or whether it's kind of these, I would say, old psychedelics, whatever, that are re-emerging. So one of the things that we have talked about is trying to get more information in this space. And if we wanted to go at least the ketamine analog, PCP analog, LSD analog type route, probably what we want to do is go to, say, like music festivals and get amnesty bins or try and sequester blotter tabs.
Yeah. So users are submitting their substances to third parties to ensure they are what they, which is safe. And I would encourage them to do that because we run into problems with people buying things that they think are this and they are something else entirely. Because we get called about all these, you know, through the poison center. I've got a kid who ate this brand of gummy that says it's a magic mushroom. And then I go online and I find lab reports from other, there are, I think actually probably a rising amount of third party testing specifically for these gray area psychedelics that are popping out. And it'll be like, oh yeah, it contains this much psilocybin and all these things. It's kind of interesting. I don't understand. It must be in the states where it's decriminalized. I'm very confused why Facebook can advertise a psilocybin containing gummy to me, because I was pretty sure they're not legal in most states. But it was a little confusing.
What the farm bill did to the cannabinoid market has really had lasting impacts way further than
CBD
and CBD. So none of that surprises me anymore.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we had a recent outbreak that we worked on with the Poison Center in New Jersey on thionephtine products that were bought from head shops that had synthetic cannabinoids in them.
Wow.
With that, we are actually now talking about expanding some of the... So we've bought some vape products from head shops just to see what semi-synthetic cannabinoids are showing up and trying to figure out, well, they're selling THC. What is PHC? Is it THC? Is it something else?
Yeah.
Is it being derived from CBD? Is there Delta 8 THC in it? What is all this? We bought some of those products, and we are thinking now that we want to do some more. We'll be going in to see, well, what's in there. We've been thinking about trying to also quantify. So if people are buying thionephtine, well, what's the amount of drug that these people are being exposed to? If people are buying even metragenine, how much metragenine is really in these powders that people are buying?
Right.
If they say they're 10 milligram capsules, are they really 10 milligram capsules or
whatever?
The Thinabut, everything, all these different sort of products that are showing up.
You just said three words that trigger, I have a love-hate relationship with, which is Phenibut, thionephtine, and metragenine. Because those things, we deal with them so often through poison centers. I find myself educating a lot of other healthcare professionals about them. I didn't see any of those on the reports. Do those get classified as traditional?
So depends on. So they don't fall on our trend reports as being NPS. Although it depends on what kind of mood we're in and kind of what the audience is and what we're talking about them. They are really this gray area. I mean, thionephtine and metragenine are not NPS themselves.
Yeah.
And the manner in which they're being used, though, in mega doses to elicit opioid-like effects absolutely falls under the definition of being an NPS,
right,
a drug used in a sort of a new and novel way. And in those scenarios, we really do sort of think about them as NPS. So they're in this kind of gray area between, I wouldn't call them really traditional drugs, although metragenine.
That's been along for a long
time. A traditional drug when you look at historically and the Earth's history, but yeah, they're kind of in this gray area. We detect them. Yeah, we continue to detect them. And
if you want to put out just a Phenibut, thionephtine, metragenine report, I know the poison centers will love it. Here's the: if you want to go do that QA on all these random products that there's a 1 in 10 chance we're going to get a call, all you got to do is disseminate that report to America's poison centers. We will be your end users. You don't have to put it out in the public. I will offer up. I'm sure we could try to find some funding. I'll give $50 myself right now. Because I would love that.
This is the question now that is not an easy one to answer, although the answer might sound easy, but tineptine, what category of NPS does it fit under?
I think we go, what dose are you using, I suppose. It's sort of, there are some mu opioid stuff going on at some point, so I guess you put it in opioids. But
I know it would probably have to go under, it would probably go under miscellaneous for us.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it's a tricyclic antidepressant, sort of. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of wild. Yeah,
same with Phenibut. I mean, that would go under miscellaneous for us. Mitragynine is the one that's, I mean, that would... That one's the one that is probably a little more clear cut that definitely could go under opioid.
Yeah.
More so, but probably still would go under miscellaneous. But yeah, that's another problem too, is how you classify some of these.
Yeah. Then that's true. And sometimes, hey, you know, we have limits in our classifications for all sorts of things. We call it one, all drugs we put into one category, but they all end up having quote unquote off target effects. That's more of a human problem. I'd like to just know what's out there either way.
Yeah. That's good. And that's actually, I know we didn't mention this, but that's actually why we lump stimulants and hallucinogens together, is because I don't want to answer the question of, is it really a stimulant or is it really a hallucinogen, when it's both?
Right.
Because you have these drugs that really do kind of span both. Some are a little bit more hallucinogenic, some are a little bit more stimulant, like 2CB.
Is 2CB
a stimulant or a hallucinogen? Depending on who you ask, some people would put 2CB as a stimulant, some people put it as a hallucinogen. So that's why we lump the two together, because of that kind of gray area and overlap in those classes. And that's why they end up being one class for our trend reports.
Hey, if you take enough stimulants, you're going to hallucinate at one point or another.
Right.
Whether it's bugs or elephants, it's going to happen. Yeah, no, that's an interesting dichotomy you got to try to straddle. Well, I can't think of a better point to end. You have answered all of my questions, and I do appreciate that. I've honestly loved just getting to hear your perspective. You're definitely deep in the on the front lines of this and learning quite a bit. So getting to hear that from you is really wonderful. Anything else you wanted to share about the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education, or the NPS Discovery Program, or anything you'd like the listeners to know?
Or just mention again that really all of our information is available open access on our website. You can either go there, as you mentioned before, by going to www.cfsre.org, or you can go to npsdiscovery.org. We've got all of our presentations that we give at meetings, which I always think is a goldmine that you can kind of go through and look at those PDFs. You can request publications that we've put in the peer-reviewed literature. And then we certainly have all the different reports, our trend reports, our monographs, our public alerts, everything that's available there. So yeah, I thank you, Ryan, so much for having me on. I always love talking about NPS. It's something that I live and breathe every day, but it is so complex, and it's kind of funny how it is also so different every time I talk with someone about NPS. What I say in April of 2024 is different than what I would have said in April of 2023, and it's going to be different than what I will say in April of 2025. Markets are always changing, but it's always great to talk about it. I know that this probably ended up being longer, but there is always just so much to pack in when you talk about all these different drug classes, all that's going on across all these different drug markets across the United States. The NPS markets across the United States remain very dynamic and really very volatile now, as you see a lot of these drugs being mixed with fentanyl. So something we've got to stay on top of, remain vigilant with, and I appreciate you having me on to talk about all that.
Thank you so much for joining. It is a full-time job just to keep up with the changes, and I'm glad that you have that full-time job can educate us. So thanks for joining, Alex. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
What an incredible discussion. Thank you again to our guest, Dr. Alex Krotulski of the Center for Forensic Science Research and Education. Once again, all of their quarterly reports, annual reports, other drug checking programs are available for free at cfsre.org. And you can check the show notes for a link to the quarterly report we talked about today and their website. I know I learned quite a lot, and I hope you did too. So many topics covered. Itizolam is out and bromazolam is in, for now, and it'll likely be on its way out again soon. We saw nitazenes with potencies potentially up to 40 times more potent than fentanyl. P-fluorofentanyl is so common that the NPS group is no longer even reporting it. And carfentanyl is unfortunately popping up all throughout the United States. Bath salts are still a problem, and N,N-dimethylpentylone seems to be the most common one. Along with cathinones, we're seeing other things, like ketamine derivatives of many different flavors, start to rise. And the synthetic cannabinoid market is back again. While regulations may have blunted it briefly, there could be a resurgence due to some creative chemistry. I hope you learned something today that you can take back to the people you work with to help educate others on what the emerging trends are. Maybe this would make a great pharmacy education whiteboard or a grand rounds topic for a medical intern. If you like what you listened to today and you want to continue to support free medical education regarding toxicology, leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And feel free to throw in a comment about what you like the most or even what you don't like. It helps other people interested in the field of toxicology find this great information. You can follow the show on Twitter at LabPoison, myself at EMPoisonFarmD. Our Facebook page is The Poison Lab, and we have an Instagram, ToxTalk. We update all the social media anytime a new show is released, so check them out to stay up to date. And you can find all free games, medical resources, and episodes of the show at www.thepoisonlab.com, where you can also find Tox Trinkets. If you feel like wrapping the show outside of the internet, go ahead and check that out. Lastly, you can reach out to the show anytime at toxtalk1@gmail.com. That's toxtalk1@gmail.com. Keep your ears peeled, as we might be releasing some mystery cases for our next episodes. I think that'll do it for today. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope we can catch you next time. Hey, Toxo, can you play us out?
The information on this show is for educational purposes only and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment recommendations. Contact your doctor for health questions or call your local poison center at 1-800-222-1222. The opinions expressed on this show do not represent those of our employers. This show is poorly written and shoddily produced by Ryan Feldman. Don't forget to give it a share with your nerdy friends. Cheerio, mates. See you next time.